Hey, Dan, guess what?
What?
If we had a band, do you know what the name of our band would be?
No.
Steely Dan.
How long have you been holding on to that one?
Like 8 hours. off to a good start.
Yep. I'm muting my yawns.
Yeah. Do you have an instructional video on how to yawn?
Sure, you can stay up really late, and then the next day, eat an entire box of macaroni and cheese for dinner while watching a movie.
Important follow-up question. what brand of boxed macaroni and cheese product was this?
This is Kraft. This is not Velveeta.
I see.
I know you always like to check to see if it's Velveeta.
And since you were using the powdered mix, did you use milk or how did the mix go? Are you using margarine or are you using?
Well, I generally follow the instructions, so there is milk, but I did not have butter, so I can't believe it's not butter.
Oh, I can't believe you did that.
Well, it's all I had here, so you know, I'm not going to go without some sort of butter substitute type product.
Okay, yeah, butter substitute and your substitute macaroni and cheese.
Yeah, I mean, you know, can't be bothered to put real cheese in it.
No, God, no. You need powder.
I do have some of that, like, shreddy cheese for, like, tacos or something. So I could have used that, I guess.
You mean actual cheese that just happens to be shredded? It's not a special kind of cheese called shreddy cheese.
No. Shreddy brand cheese.
shreddy brand. For when you absolutely need to get shredded? I don't know. Shredded on cheese. What if they had...
It's a special type of cheese formulated for skateboarders.
Yeah, well, they have the... I don't know if you're familiar with this, but in Spain, they have a goat cheese where they wash the rind in red wine. But the cheese itself is not alcoholic. But what if you had alcoholic cheese? What if it was, you know, you could get drunk on cheese?
I would definitely go for that. I had some nice goat brie this weekend.
Oh, okay. That's nice.
Yeah, it was good.
A nice grassy flavor?
Grassy flavor? No, it tasted like goat cheese.
Oh, okay. Some chevre?
Yes. Welcome to Cheese Talk.
The talkiest.
I guess we can bookend a slightly unpleasant topic with good topics. We'll start with the cheese, and then do you want to move on to talking about Spider-Man?
Yeah, the Spider-Man's from Connecticut. So cheese, great stuff. And perhaps there could be some sort of an integral product in the future where there's like spray cheese that you shoot out of your wrists on, and it could be like cheese slingers. And then you could incorporate that.
That sounds delicious, actually.
Yeah. Could you imagine? And you like get it to, maybe they can formulate it so that it like sticks to the wall and it's like string cheese.
If I could get a spray cheese that had an effective distance of about 20 feet, that would just be endless fun just to hang out at home and try and like shoot cheese and see if you could catch it in your mouth.
I'm not gonna.
We're talking about cheese here, Joe.
Yeah. Just
keep it above deck.
Just shoot it and catch it in your mouth. All right, so above the deck.
You are the worst.
I had nothing to do with the thing that you said. But the
why do you have to? Why do you have to ruin everyone's love of cheese?
Because I can. But the.
I mean, always going for the easy joke.
Yeah. Dumb question. But the news about Spider-Man, Spider-Man, important spelling note for everybody really concerned about that.
Is the hyphen is the canonical spelling?
Yes. And most of the time you'll see people do Spider-Man all one word with a lowercase m, and then sometimes you'll see it like camel case, like Spider-Man with the capital M, and then sometimes you'll see it with the space in between. And then the rarest form is, of course, the actual correct one, which is the one where there's a hyphen. And that generally, follows people actually reading a bunch of things that they can copy and paste the text from. Most of the time when they're just, you know, if you were to like stop someone on the street and just be like, quiz, answer this now, or suffer.
Pop quiz, hot shot.
Yes, it will shoot cheese in your eye. answer this. Most of the time, people will omit the hyphen and spell it in a variety of other ways.
I believe the old iOS, when it's on its game, auto-corrects it with the hyphen properly.
Mm. Well, good for Apple for respecting Disney's intellectual property. But the which takes us to the interesting part, which is intellectual property, everybody's favorite subject. The intellectual property situation is interesting because Marvel, as a company, was run rather poorly for several decades, culminating in a point where they had a resurgence in foil-covered nonsense in the 90s and playing cards and all kinds of just bad nonsensical investments in alternative things. And then the whole market collapsed because guess what? And people just didn't want to buy as many things. And then the whole thing resulted in Marvel licensing out its intellectual property to film studios. And the initial plan was to just license it out to a bunch of different film studios to see, you know, what each of them would do with it. Because it wasn't like there was any previous good Marvel movie in existence. There had been previous attempts at making Marvel things on the big and small screens, and they were all awful, universally panned, terrible things. So what's the worst that could happen? And the answer is apparently like Daredevil and The Punisher and Fantastic Four, and just like there were bad things that happened from this, but then there were also good things. And the Sam Raimi Spider-Man movies were good. The initial X-Men movies with Bryan Singer were well received at the time, although let's just say they don't hold up super well in viewings these days. So let's just not look at those closely. But the whole thing was that nobody really knew what they were doing with it, and they made a mess. And all these different film studios made a mess. But from these experiments, this little like petri dish of different movies being made, one thing that came out of it was Iron Man, one of the later ones from Paramount Pictures. And this is what resulted in a lot of the stuff that we know now as the Marvel Cinematic Universe, or at least what you think of as Marvel movies. Because they all have a strand of DNA from that goes forwards. And our movie last week, Jon Favreau, seems to have some subtle commentary on somebody's position on how he feels about directing those things. But the whole thing's kind of a mess in that, Disney bought up everything, all of the properties that they could buy up from Paramount and, Universal. Because otherwise they have to wait for these things to lapse, because another weird thing about the contracts is that as long as the movie studio is still making stuff with the intellectual property and releasing on a schedule, then they can just keep going with that intellectual property for basically a really long time. And Disney can't just get it back automatically. But if they stop developing things, then they get it back. And so I think like Daredevil they got back because Fox is like, screw this. This is not really worth our time.
didn't work out super well, and they weren't going to try it again. But yeah. this is why we had that. Like, I don't even, was it released in theaters? That super weird Roger Corman Fantastic Four.
That was in the '80s, wasn't it?
Yeah, but didn't that happen as a result of like a licensing deal that they just had to make something with it, or they were going to lose it?
No.
What am I thinking of? Wasn't there a Fantastic Four project that existed solely for the purpose of maintaining the rights?
I'm not sure exactly what you're thinking of. There was a Fantastic Four movie that came out with Chris Evans in it,
and
then a sequel to that one, and those were about keeping the rights for the Fantastic Four properties. But I'm not familiar with the Roger Corman thing you're referring to.
Well, it's a really terrible one that nobody should see.
Okay, well that's good. Thanks, Dan.
You're welcome.
The whole thing is that a lot of people feel that these days Disney has sort of perfected the formula of making these Marvel movies, and not only that, but they have so many of the other characters that it would be nice to have some of the other characters that are not owned by Disney right now come back into the fold so that everybody can be in one big happy family and they can all be in one big franchised production that spans multiple years and multiple movies and multiple toy lines. But the studios that are holding on to X-Men and holding on to Spider-Man are reluctant to give that back up. And I believe we had touched on this before in previous episodes, but Sony has all the Spider-Man stuff and they keep making Spider-Man stuff. And after the Raimi movies, they rebooted with the Mark Webb movies. And then after Mark Webb's second movie, the certainty about the third movie kind of wobbled a little bit. And they pushed it back behind their movies that were going to be spin-offs because they're trying to make as many movies with the intellectual property that they have as they can. Because another restriction is they can only use the Spider-Man properties for making things. Like, they can't have the Kingpin in it because that's technically not a Spider-Man character. It is technically a Daredevil character. But he's in many Spider-Man stories. So it is sort of a fascinating, weird, interleaving thing going on there. Where they're sort of isolated and they were trying to make their own like Avengers as much as they could out of it by having like the Sinister Six movie come out and then having a Venom movie come out, and have them nominally be tied into the Spider-Man universe that they had, which was separate from the Marvel continuity as a whole. And interestingly, in the first Amazing Spider-Man movie, they were going to have Stark Tower appear in the New York skyline of the first Amazing Spider-Man, and they were going to have Oscorp Tower appear in the New York skyline in the Avengers movie. That didn't work out for whatever reason before they actually went ahead to go do it. So that would have been kind of an interesting additional twist on the situation now, because today, well, yesterday, yesterday night, they announced that Sony had reached a deal with Marvel to exchange, in sort of a cross-licensing way, characters and ideas, and that Kevin Feige, I always forget how to pronounce his name.
I think it's Feige.
Feige, yeah. They say it all the time on script notes, and then I'm just like, I draw a blank. But Kevin Feige, he is like the head honcho of all of the Marvel products that they do and oversees all of the things. And that includes Captain America, includes Avengers and everything. I mean, but he's been with all of the Marvel movies going back until, you know, the Punisher movie and Daredevil movie that I derided not so very long ago in this discussion. But he's the one who basically is acknowledged as the brains behind what they're doing these days. Now, that's not to say that he isn't capable of making any mistakes, or that Marvel itself is an infallible machine that only produces high quality material. But people feel more confident in them doing things than they feel confident in Sony doing things with the Spider-Man properties. That is an emotional argument to make. And so you can come down whatever way you want to on that.
How do you think Sony feels on the matter? Do you think they think Marvel is just really hitting their stride and they want to let them have a run at the character, but they keep some licensing rights? Do you think that's where this came from?
Well, one of the things that was leaked by the hackers from the whole interview mess in December was that they had apparently been in discussions before to exchange these characters, and they had fallen out over who could maintain creative control over this stuff.
Right. Wasn't there like a bulleted item in an email that said something like, why aren't these movies more popular? Bad storyline? Bad directing? Just like a whole bunch of questions that they didn't appear to have any answers for?
Yeah, well, no comment. And so the...
No, I mean, like in the email, was that not the case? There was like a giant list where they went, what's going on here?
No, I don't know the... I can't remember the actual... I don't think I saw the email. I just remember reading the articles at the time about this. Because, you know, everybody was having fun going through it. The situation, though, right now seems to be very similar to that, in that they have this exchange going on. But it does appear that Marvel has the creative control they wanted. But the other thing is that there's no actual money exchanging hands. which is interesting because one of the weird things that I was reading about in December when all of the hacking stuff was happening and all of the leaks were happening was that there were a lot of nerds who were making the argument, well, now Marvel has to sell it back. They have to sell it back to Disney because they need the money. That's why they have to do it. And it's just like, well, apparently it's not about the money at all. So thanks, pissant nerds. I don't know what you were thinking. But the situation now is that they have creative control for the most part, except apparently Sony maintains like some sort of, I don't know, veto power or something. It says that they have final say, but I'm imagining a situation where they are probably going to let Marvel basically just do the stuff. It's sort of like having somebody do your homework for you, and they're going to do a better job anyway, so you just sort of stay out of their way, and then you get to reap the rewards of all of that happening. Namely, box office rewards, because the Amazing Spider-Man movies have not done amazingly well. In fact, they haven't done as well as the previous three Spider-Man movies. And it's debatable, you know, I mean, it's like, oh, well, those are so many years ago, and like the economy is different, and the way people consume media is different, so who's to say that it is exactly a one-to-one thing? But...
Yeah, we were talking about it on Twitter yesterday, mm-hmm. that the second Amazing Spider-Man movie made $700-something million, which is nothing to scoff at, but if you look at Captain America, I think 2 is the one that made about the same $700 million, Captain America 1 was like... $300 million in gross. So that one doubled, more than doubled pretty quickly. And if you had had this long a run with Spider-Man, theoretically, you could do something that was interesting enough to, I don't know, gain more traction with the audience. I'm not sure. But I mean, it's not like $700 million should be considered a failure. Even if this movie is, you know, as expensive as any of the most expensive movies at like $300 million, you're still making profit on that. But presumably, like you said, they want... The Marvel folks who they perceive to be doing the most interesting things creatively, and you know, opportunity to do the most interesting things because they have all these other characters to work with, they want to give them the opportunity to do the writing, but they want to hang on to a little bit of the credit or revenue. It's still kind of a weird thing, right?
Well, it's highly unusual. And if you read any of the reporting on this from Variety or anywhere else. None of this is really expected, and the way it's unfolded is not hasn't happened with anything in the past. But we haven't really had a situation like Marvel in the past. It's not like
right. I can't think of another like 40 movie story arc that has happened before with multiple characters.
Well, I mean, you could say like, well, Bond has had very contentious things surrounding intellectual property rights and licensing and. When somebody was working on screenplays and then they would take that work and go off on their own thing. Cause like, what was it? Thunderball. I think they made that like a couple times that movie, they made it as like an independent production cause the writer left and did his own like off brand Bond basically. It's very, it is very weird. You know, it doesn't have the scope of characters or anything like that. It's not like we had like a run of like Felix movies or something like that. And I'm not talking about Felix the Cat. I'm talking about Felix Leiter.
Felix the Cat would make a great Avenger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's got that magic bag. He can just pull shit out of that. And
he's really good at telling time while his eyes bounce back and forth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that would be really distracting for Ultron.
I always wondered one of those clocks.
Yeah. Me too. But the, and you know, a lot of conjecture is like, well, the reason why Marvel wanted this so badly is because Spider-Man was a big character in the Civil War comic book arc. And that they kind of need him, basically. They feel they need him, I guess, for the version of that they want to tell with the Avengers stuff. And
right, because the premise is it splits between Iron Man and Captain America, and what, Spider-Man sides with Captain America or something in terms of this big moral argument they have.
No, actually, he signs with the... Well, spoiler alert. I don't know.
Spoiler alert. How old is this storyline?
I don't know. And they're probably going to change whatever it is in the movie anyways. It doesn't matter. But in the comics, it was... He sided with Iron Man.
Well, that makes sense. Iron Man's got the money.
Yeah, and he gave him a weird suit. That's the fact. But the situation apparently now is that there will be a new Peter Parker, not Andrew Garfield, not Tobey Maguire, and that they will do things with it that I'm going to assume will have absolutely nothing to do with the previous Spider-Man movies or the Amazing Spider-Man movies, which means it's the third reboot in like 15 years of this franchise. That's not
terribly different from Hulk at all, if we're honest.
Well,
Hulk just didn't really get, you know, a trilogy before getting rebooted.
Yeah. There is some hope that maybe, just maybe, we won't have to sit through his origin story for a third mother freaking time, because if there's one thing I don't need to see, it's some gawky teenager in a lab getting bitten by a spider who... It doesn't. We know that. Like, humanity.
I think everyone knows that by now.
Humanity. Babies are born today, and in their mitochondrial DNA, inherited from their mothers, they are passed down the knowledge that Spider-Man was bitten by a radioactive spider. That is the end. No one needs to hear this again. It is ridiculous. And there is.
Yeah, but how does this character feel about his missing parents? Yes, I agree. Hopefully there is absolutely no telling of the origin. Maybe they can reference it in passing in a line or two of dialogue. But yeah, we definitely don't need any more Spider-Man origin story.
Oh, yeah. God, no. And the situation is also strange in that there are people who are pushing for not Peter Parker to be the Spider-Man. There's another character in the Marvel Ultimates line, which is a alternate universe to the regular Marvel universe, which are both alternate universes to the Marvel Comics universe, which is in the movies. Anyway.
You lost me.
Yeah, I know. Everybody's lost. The whole situation is apparently there's multiple... These characters are mythological, and you can retell their origins, and you can retell who they are, and you can retell things about them, and you can spin off characters that are like them or unlike them in some ways, and that they have a certain they are iconic and mean something other than just literally being this character over the span of time, because that wouldn't make any sense why he'd still be a high school student right now. But he will be a high school student, and it will be Peter Parker, and it won't be Miles Morales, who was, let's put it this way. Peter Parker is a white guy, and Peter Parker will join the pantheon of other white men in the Marvel universe, leading movies. And, the Black Panther movie and the, Captain Marvel movie, are both being pushed back by the addition of Spider-Man now, and the as well as the Thor movie and the Captain America movie are being pushed back a year for Spider-Man to do his thing in July of 2017. So,
in a solo movie under Marvel's guidance?
He's going to appear in a Marvel movie before he appears in a Sony movie, but. I'm assuming that means an end title cameo or something, because
I still got time to cram him into the end of Avengers 2.
Yeah, well, you know how they operate over there at Marvel. They're like, yeah, let's just have our mid credit scene and our end credit scene, and then our oh my god, you thought we were actually done scene. It's how they do things. And they like to drop little seeds for what the next movie will be, or what some other little plot thread will expand into in some future thing. Like Thanos was shown in the
Avengers 1.
Yeah, end of the Avengers. And, like the fact that Loki was still alive was shown at the end of the Thor movie. So, you know, all of this stuff, like they like to tease things out because they have so much, runway for where they're going with these stories. I mean, what was it? It was Comic-Con that they like show, I think it was Comic-Con, New York City Comic-Con maybe, or San Diego, I can't remember. They showed like the bulletin board of like where they're going with all of their movies, and they have everything like plotted out, I think until like 2025 or something. Yeah. So now they're squeezing in a little Spidey in here.
Well, they've got till May 1st, which is the release date for Avengers 2, to, I guess, cast Spider-Man and shoot a quick scene to get in the end.
Yep. It'll be great.
Really tight deadline. It's interesting that we haven't heard anything about the recasting. I imagine they're already thinking about it, or at least they'd have to be.
Well, I mean, the news came out Monday, so I'm sure they didn't even have this stuff together to put out this announcement until like
if I was Marvel, I would have been thinking this whole time like, man, wouldn't it be great once we get the rights back to use such and such person for Mr. Spider-Man?
Well, perhaps, but since they want to cast someone that is presumably young enough to pull off this role for many, many years to come, because remember, like Andrew Garfield, I think is like 30, 31 right now. He aged out of being a teen very fast. So they are probably going to cast someone as young as possible. But there aren't usually a lot of, actors or actresses that are familiar to a wide variety of audiences and audience members in that age bracket. You know, it's not like everybody's like, oh, Harrison Ford or something like that. Because, you know, those actors are more famous later on in their lives because their acting work tends to be better later on in their lives. I mean, even Jennifer Lawrence isn't actually, you know, that young, really, when she got famous.
They should get the kid from Iron Man 3 who's older now and in Jurassic World.
Ugh.
Just give him a haircut.
No, I think they should get the Game of Thrones guy who was in Maze Runner. That guy.
I haven't seen either of those. Things.
Well, this is why we're not casting the next Spider-Man, obviously.
he wasn't the obnoxious little skinny blonde kid, was he, in Game of Thrones?
I'm not sure how to say this because I think you're thinking of a different one, but he was annoying to me, but he wasn't supposed to be. So I think you're thinking of Joffrey.
Yeah, that's the one I'm thinking of.
Yeah. I mean, I guess they could cast him, but he seems ill-suited for it. I'm thinking of the Warg one, who you wouldn't know probably because I think you only watched like 5 minutes of Game of Thrones, so the odds are pretty low. But he could maybe do it. I don't know. Maybe we'll see where they go with it. I have no interest in really picking it apart because, like I said, statistically the odds are pretty low that either one of us will guess right for whatever they end up casting. And who knows? They could do something like what Fox did with the Fantastic Four, where they, you know, might even consider casting someone who was not ethnically the same as that character was in the comic books. So while it might not be Miles Morales, it might spiritually be Miles Morales. It might just have the name of Peter Parker. Who knows what they will do? Because there's so little information, and this has changed very rapidly in a very short amount of time. Also, we should say that Amy Pascal and Amy Pascal's production company at Sony will be overseeing the creative side of the Spider-Man movies, but according to Moises Trion, he has sources that say that she is just nominally part of this, and it is a face-saving thing, but I haven't seen any sources that back up what he says, but, you know, who knows? Maybe he knows. I have no idea. The thing about that that's interesting is she stepped down recently, last week, as the head of Sony Pictures Movies, and she was a co in that role with Michael Linton. So now he's there doing it, and she's running a production company still at Sony, but in a production role where she's just a producer. Is interesting for a variety of reasons because she also oversaw all of the other previous Spider-Man movies. So she has a familiarity with the franchise, which I don't know if she does actually have creative input. Maybe it won't help, or maybe it will. It could maybe she'll be like, yeah, that didn't work last time. Let's do something else. Who knows? Cause also in the past they had, Avi Arad, who was, the, guy who was in charge of Marvel, movies across the board for all of their previous efforts before Disney bought up everything. And then he was just in charge of Spider-Man, and the Matt Tomalak, another producer, and they're both apparently out of this. They're just executive producer titles on the stuff and will not actually, you know, well, I don't have to explain it to you, but can you explain to the listeners what an executive producer does?
Ostensibly the term executive in front of producer means that they have, financial, involvement in a film, but they also have very high level creative direction on the film as well. So they're mostly there in an advisory role. They're not really in the day-to-day making phone calls and cutting deals, but they're the high-powered ones at the top who can tug on the purse strings to make their decisions final when required.
Also, sometimes from some other sources, you will hear that, like, Gene Roddenberry, for example, often received an executive producer title, but they basically didn't let him do anything anymore because he was not very good at his job for Star Trek movies. So he still got to
at that
have
point,
that.
Yeah, it's more of an honorary title.
Yeah, there is. I am leaning more towards they probably just have an honorary title in this particular case.
I mean, they're not going to give a person of Amy's stature anything but an executive producer credit.
Oh, I'm sure she is actually going to be involved in some way. Who could predict what it will be? So we'll see how it all unfolds. But it is just sort of a fascinating change from where everything was previously to this point, especially given the fact that we know that they had wanted to work together in the past, and that we know that Sony felt things weren't working, and we know that Disney really wanted to have the character incorporated in their stuff. So to see this all sort of like integrate in sort of a, let's just say like bloodless way, maybe it'll all go well. Who can say? But
cautiously optimistic about the future of the Spider-Mans.
Yes. Speaking of Marvel movies, and speaking of Disney, is there perhaps a Marvel Disney film you would care to discuss today?
Sure. This evening we have selected.
Does it have a number in the title?
It does. Also includes a batch of superheroes.
Uh-huh. Is the number greater than 5?
Just barely, yes.
Okay. So is it less than 7?
It is indeed.
Okay. Now, would you describe the number of heroes as small?
Why no, Joe? No, I would not.
Oh, so how would you describe this overall?
I would describe them as a big group of heroes totaling the number of 6.
Oh, okay. So what could possibly be the name of this film?
It is Avengers: Age of Ultron, the trailer.
Yes, I'm really excited about this.
Redux.
Yes. String. pulling string.
Mangoes.
Yes.
No,
Hairy baby.
I did like that part. We're talking about Disney's Big Hero 6. Hooray!
Yay!
2014 movie.
Woo. and we're talking about it because Dan thought it would be historically relevant for us to discuss things that are nominated for awards in this award season.
And by suggesting that they are historically relevant, it just means that there are a lot of Oscar-nominated movies that I had not yet seen that I wanted to see, and we might as well talk about them while we're at it.
Yes, this podcast is an excellent excuse to see things. I'm not being facetious. That's actually true, because I hadn't seen this either until Dan had said this. But it's not just Oscar-nominated for animated. Best Animated Picture of 2014. It was also nominated for a variety of other awards, including the Visual Effects Society Awards, of which it is the first animated film ever to win all of the animated film categories, which is interesting, because that is, well, that's the first time that's happened. So, ta-da!
Hooray!
Good job, guys. But I think that's 5 awards and not 6 awards, so that's kind of not great. They should have added another award just so they could round it all out and it could match.
Well, I don't think Baymax really needs an award. He's rather selfless.
Yeah, but he did get an award for best animation.
we should get this like out right away that Baymax is absolutely the highlight of this movie, and it would have been nothing without him.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to discuss my overall feelings as well, because I believe I had shared this with you, because I saw it first this weekend, that I really thought it was a visually stunning film, but I feel that the story is actually pretty weak, especially in comparison to other Disney and Pixar films, of which many of this production team has overseen things before. It's not to say it is bad, but I definitely have some bones to pick with it over decisions that they made creatively. I cannot stress enough, though, that I think that it is beautiful and totally worth seeing, and I think that everybody should give it a check out of the thing, of the library. Go to your library.
Go to your local library mm-hmm. and check out.
Yeah.
What is that? WorldCat?
What's the name of that thing?
What?
WorldCat or whatever it is? Library Cat? What's the name of that site? The cat
site.
Oh,
I thought it was a platypus. No, I have no idea what it was. The thing, Library Elf.
Hello. No, but the... Okay. So anyway, we'll consult with the sources of the things that would know. By that, I mean I'm probably going to just Google. But expect to see it in the show notes. Dan, where might people find the show notes?
Wherever it is that you're currently listening to this, look down about 20 pixels and it'll be right there.
What if they're listening to this on an iPod Shuffle?
Then they don't know how to use the internet anyways.
Oh, Dan, that is so mean to our listeners. You shouldn't be so judgmental. Now, I got a question for you. Would it be at like something called, like, I don't know, defocus.co?
Presumably.
Would there be like a slash after that? And then could it be a number that might be greater than, I don't know, 34? Could it be a number that might be less than, I don't know, 35? 36? I mean, what kind of number are we thinking?
You're on a math kick tonight, aren't you? Yes, this will be defocus.co/35 for your show notes, or in your podcast app where you're listening to this, or on the webpage that you're probably looking at right now, or in iTunes.
And that's great. So anyway, there will be a cat library cat thing. There's cat. And so moving on, I think that you should check it out and you should watch it and give it a perusal. You will not be shocked or surprised by any twist or turn in this film.
No, not at all.
None of them were surprising.
You know, there's a handful of moments that you're just watching and you're like, can we fast forward 5 minutes? Because I know what you're getting at already. I mean, there were a couple of surprises that I didn't see coming. I don't know about you. I guess we'll jump right into spoiler mode. Like, they do cram a lot of story into this hour and 40 minutes, which I guess they kind of had to. But it does kind of affect how we perceive the stakes of the movie, wherein our main character, Hero, goes very quickly from just this genius kid who is not interested in school or anything. He's just hustling people in back alley robot wars in San Francisco, which was, I thought, interesting but very odd. San Francisco, it's shaped like San Francisco, but it looks like Tokyo. And then his older brother, Tadashi, is going to school at a very prominent college in the city, and he works in a robotics lab, and he tricks the kid into coming on a tour and convinces him that he needs to go to the school. And then he's all interested in going to the school now, so he's no longer just scoffing at education. And then all of a sudden, he's trying to impress everyone to get into the school, and then he does get into the school, and then his big brother has to die in a fire explosion. And now he is sad, and he doesn't want to go to the school again.
Wait. You forgot an important part.
Very quickly. Yes.
You forgot an important part. And we are introduced to a nefarious seeming fellow named Cray. And we are also introduced to the professor, who seems stalwart and true. And then the professor dies in the fire.
And it is presumed shortly thereafter that the fire was caused by the bad person, Mr. Cray, because he really wanted to buy Hero's little demo invention, which could be used for a great many things.
The microbots.
But the microbots. And our very kind and generous Professor Callahan advises to steer clear of the man with the money because he has ulterior motives. And then boom, the brother dies. Everyone's sad. And then we get onto the real plot of the movie.
Yes. Which is Baymax and how great he is. He is not what I would consider to be a practical robot. and his design seems very flexible in terms of the technical proficiency that he is able to demonstrate at any particular moment in regards to what needs to be done in the story. But he is fascinating in his childlike wonder, and his,
he is designed to be non-threatening to people.
Yes. His non-threatening inflatable design.
I love that he recognizes how large he is and he looks down and sees the obstacles he has to slowly walk around, and he just sidesteps and just squeezes through tight areas or he moves things. But yes, it is, his childlike wonder is adorable in this giant, puffy inflatable robot.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, and we are very at the very, very first scene of which we are introduced to him. We of course see that he has a little memory port, and inside the little memory port is a little memory card. And we are given the line that this is what makes him who he is. And not that that will ever come into play at all in the story. Don't expect that. Don't expect that.
Yeah. You know the old adage, you put a memory card on the mantle in the first act and you got to pick it up in the third.
Mm-hmm. Unless it's HFS plus formatted. But the ding, but the, who knows? I mean, he's probably on a better file system than that. Or maybe since it's a memory, little memory card, it might just be FAT32. I mean, that stuff's still kicking around and all that. Anyway. So he's great. I like him and you like him. He's
a medical robot, mm-hmm. with the intention of being able to assess damage in patients and heal them. And anytime he hears someone in distress by saying ouch or something thereof, he wakes up out of his little box, inflates, he scans people, and then he helps them get better. That is his goal in life.
Yes.
Or not life, because he's a robot.
Right. Well, he is not given, let's just say, his scope for what he's expected to deal with seems to be impractical. Like, if someone says ouch, and then he's triggered and he inflates, and then there's nothing visibly wrong, like, he should just be able to just deactivate. Like, if somebody, you know, is
having, if it was a false alarm, yeah, rather than having to wait around till somebody says, I am satisfied with my...
With my care.
Although maybe, you know, a lot of people refuse medical care because they don't want the hassle, but he's got to persist until he can actually help.
Yeah, but what if he can scan them so he can see that they're fine and then just be like, all right, well, peace out. But he can't do that.
Then he learns that there is more to it than just physical harm. There is mental health to worry about as well. And he has to help Hiro because he is sad.
Yes, he's really good at mental health. By that, I mean he's not good at mental health.
Well, he downloaded a database from touching a computer.
Mm-hmm. And then he called his friends. We should talk about the friends who were actually introduced early in the film. When the brother takes him to the school to sort of con him into going to the school by showing him how cool everything is at the nerd school. We are introduced to all of the characters who are all quirky nerds. There is, of course, Tamago, who is kind of like what's her face in the Lego movie, and then there's Wasabi with Damon Wayans Jr. There's Honey Lemon, who is I guess her name's Genesis Rodriguez, so that's an interesting name. And there is a
Fred. Don't forget Fred.
Yes, Fred. TJ Miller, who was not in the news at all for any reason.
Once again, doing his great impression of TJ Miller in this
movie. Yes. TJ Miller plays TJ Miller really well. We should, of course, point out that TJ Miller plays a version of TJ Miller that seems non-threatening in this film. Doesn't call anybody any mean words, so that's good for him. It certainly does not yell at the girlfriend of the CEO of Uber.
Well, this is San Francisco, so maybe there is a different version of Uber there, and he's okay with that one.
Sure. We're introduced to all of them and how quirky they are, and Fred is of course, shown to not actually be a student there, but just sort of hangs out there. And he's like kind of a stoner, but in a comic cartoon way where he's not actually really a stoner, because that would be wrong.
He's the wackadoodle sidekick that's giving everyone their silly nicknames because Damon Wayans Jr. spilled wasabi on his shirt one time, and that's why his nickname is Wasabi.
Yes. And I can't remember the Honey and Lemon story. But they're all demonstrated, of course, with like a certain specialty, which of course will never come into play later. And they're all introduced really quickly, and then they're forgotten about for like 15, 20 minutes. But when Baymax calls them up, and then he's like, no, don't do that. And then, you know, he's like, oh, well, if I follow this microbot, will it make you feel any better? And then, you know, she's like, sure, because he doesn't actually think he's going to do it. And then he does it. And then there's the chase scene through the city and to the warehouse where they're all being microbot made. And I don't know. Like a 3D printing lab.
He follows him to the warehouse where we discover that his microbots were not destroyed in the explosion that killed his brother. They were, in fact, stolen and are being mass-produced for apparently some nefarious purpose.
Shock. And we are also introduced to a man in a mask, which seems strange because if you don't know anyone's coming, why do you have a mask? But
he was looking for... perhaps something that will shield his face while he is on his microbot transport and moving rapidly through the city, or maybe through the ocean or something. He needs something to protect himself from, you know, debris or birds or what have you.
Yeah.
And he also needs to integrate the cerebral control of the microbots.
Yeah, and he needs something to disguise the completely obvious fact if I knew who this was the second that I saw the man in the mask.
you didn't think it was Cray for even a moment?
There, not a single brain cell in my head thought that this would be Cray. Now, Alan Tudyk, who voices Cray, had played a Disney villain in a prior movie and also played a Disney not nice guy in a prior movie, which is strange because he's in a lot of them. I guess he's sort of like the what's his face from Cheers, who's in all the Pixar movies now. You got to have Alan Tudyk in all of your Disney movies. But Alan Tudyk, who had, of course, played a very mean person in Wreck-It Ralph, and then, of course, had also played a not terribly nice person in Frozen, and then, of course, here is Cray, so maybe he's not a nice guy again, except, of course, that wouldn't actually be the case, because why? But it is, of course, shall we do, like, a spoiler horn or something? Do you want to make
I think we're well past spoiler horns.
Can you do a crow? Can you cup your hands?
Let's do the sound of a pig oinking to celebrate that our bad guy is a man who may or may not have once put a shotgun in the face of an adorable talking pig.
Oh, I didn't see Babe.
Are you kidding me?
I've never seen Babe.
He was going to shoot the pig.
Okay, well, he was played Zefram Cochran in First Contact, and he did a really good job.
It's always Star Trek with you.
It is always Star Trek with me. But anyway, James Cromwell, who doesn't really talk that much in this movie, he is, of course, the professor who was idolized at the beginning of the film and who obviously had a problem with Cray, and then who is obviously, well, one of the two missing people who would be most likely to be the person inside of this mask. The other being, of course, his brother, which seems... well, not likely. And as I already said, Cray seems unlikely just by virtue of the fact that it was too obvious. It's sort of like a, you know, if you're a little child, I'm sure that you could actually be surprised by these things because the odds are pretty low that they watch Law & Order SVU. But for any of us...
One would hope.
Yes, for any of the more sophisticated people in the audience who had seen any of the misadventures of Detective Elliot Stabler and Mershka Haggerty, there's nothing really surprising here. You set up like the person who could be the bad guy but isn't really the bad guy, and it really turns out to be the person that you think's the good guy. I mean, it's so obvious that I had this nailed in the scene, and then I had to sit there while these characters could not figure out who this was for, like, what, 30 minutes? It drove me crazy. So,
well, this is the thing, though. Yes, he's absolutely the obvious choice for the bad guy in that first scene where we meet him because we're told he's the bad guy. But everything else in this movie is so obvious that I thought maybe they're making it so obvious so we'll think it's not him, but maybe it will be him, like they doubled back on themselves, but of course that was not the case.
Yeah, yeah.
I tricked myself.
No, but they didn't trick themselves. They didn't trick anybody, except, I don't know, maybe some three-year-olds, like, oh, God, and they covered their eyes in the theater and they're crying.
Well, this is a PG movie, so...
Yeah, whatever. Parents don't pay any attention to that. You think they're going to, like, get a babysitter for one of their kids? No, they just drag them all. The thing is, that made it really frustrating to enjoy the rest of the film in this part where they couldn't figure out who the bad guy was, because it was so so clear to me who it was that I kept focusing on what idiots they all were.
At a very minimum, we had some manner of mystery around why the bad guy would be doing this. It seemed like, yes, there was great potential in these microbots, that you could do all sorts of villainous things with them, but we had no idea what this person was doing for a very long time, or why he was doing them until we take our little trip to not Alcatraz.
Yeah, to Quarantine Island. Let's just get it all out of the way. And then the thing that bothers me is they go there to the island, which has the video queued up to exactly when they need to
see.
Well,
he does have to rewind it a little bit.
Oh, yeah. It's very difficult for them to get exactly where they need to go. They basically just wander in there, and there's this giant red screen. It's like, oh, push the button. They show the experiment with Cray and how it went horribly wrong. It's like, well, this girl who went in the pod and then was fired through the thing, obviously someone cared for her. So who could that be? Of course, it would be the professor who has a problem with Cray. And of course, they couldn't.
I like that the first time they watch the video, they pause it like immediately as soon as they see the girl go into the thing and Cray like trying to help get her out. They immediately just hit pause. Like, no, it doesn't occur to us that maybe we should watch this video to the end until a little bit later.
No, well, okay. It really bugs me because this is another case where, like, for the next, I don't know, what, 3-5 minutes, they still can't figure out that it's the professor. They still can't figure out the relationship between these characters, and it's like, of course it's the daughter. Like, literally, I'm like, as I'm watching this, all like every little thing that's happening on the screen, like as it happens, I'm like, of course it's the daughter, of course that's why he hates Cray, of course that's why he's taking these parts and he's going to rebuild the thing over in the, like, it all makes sense. And to see these characters stumbling so hard, and they're like, why? What could this possibly mean? And it's like, are you kidding me? What do you mean?
Since you have all of the answers, can you tell me why the device that was quarantined, or the device that had the issue and sent the girl into wherever it sent her instead of properly through the Stargate, why was it broken up into pieces and thrown out into the bay?
Wait. No, but I thought that was I thought he was dismantling the one that didn't blow up and taking that one.
But, like, I thought he was bringing pieces of it back to Alcatraz when they, in that first scene where they chase him
He was bringing them from the island to the mainland, because that was the docks on the mainland.
And he was just dragging them underwater and then happened to lift it up in some dramatic fashion with the microbots?
I thought so. I didn't think they actually... I did not think that he was recovering the broken one, because it seemed like that one was disintegrated.
Okay, because that makes sense, because that was the one that was left in place on Quarantine Island, and the pieces of the one that did function, at least temporarily, to send the girl away, did work, and that's the one he took to the end.
Yeah. But
still seems rather odd that he used the microbots as his transportation. Like, he couldn't just, like, get a boat or something.
You already got the microbots, so what?
Right, I know, but like, why would he show his hand so quickly with the microbots when he could just, like, let's keep this under wraps for a little while longer before we let the city know that there's a crazy man with microbots and a mask running around with pieces of a machine?
Yeah, but
whatever.
Literally no one in the city cared. Even when they had that big car chase from the docks and in their dinky little car.
There really wasn't anyone on the streets with them, was there?
No, there were a couple cars here and there, but really not a crazy car chase. But literally no one saw this or whatever, because it didn't make the news or anything. So it's not like his identity, his cover was blown here for his secret plan, because no one could figure it out. And even if they had seen it, something tells me they still couldn't figure it out, because none of them seemed to really like snap to it at any point in this film. But when they're on the island and they do finally piece all of it together and they're like, oh, it was your daughter. That's who it is. Remember that? And it's just like, what? Just drag it out more, guys. And they have that all unfold. And then it's like, well, of course, this is why all of the things in this film have happened. And we know this, like, everyone in the audience has figured all this stuff out. It's incredibly frustrating for me. And they've had...
Yeah, and the video was very not subtle, was it? Because the Cray, you know, the guy running the machine said, you know, there's a little bit of a fluctuation in the gravity field or whatever the hell he said. And then Cray says, no big deal. It's within our tolerances. Fire away. And then that's obviously the part where everything goes wrong. And then, of course, Callahan comes running out going, you knew it was unsafe and you did it anyway. It's like, bro... You're a scientist. You're aware of things like tolerances and risk. And like, why would you be involved in this and let your daughter get fired into the thing? Like,
but first of all, why
are we not still using monkeys to test things? I mean, no offense. It would be very sad if a monkey was lost in hypersleep in that portal thing for a very long time. But you're going to go right to human trials of like one of the co-founder's daughters?
You obviously go hat to human. That's what we do here. You know,
right. You throw a hat through the Stargate. The hat worked just fine. Let me fire my only daughter into the Stargate.
Yes, in a rocket ship, because obviously, if you need a rocket ship for it, then it must be safe. But the I don't know. What was also the plan to like slow this thing down when it came through the other side? It was very strange. The whole thing didn't really make a lot of sense. But you will notice that they watch this and they watch Callahan's reaction and they watch that it's his daughter and they're like, oh no, like that's the reason why. And now Cray wants to cover
that
it
thing
up.
Where they get all CSI where they zoom in on her helmet to see that it says Callahan on the side, and then they find another camera angle where Callahan is hugging her, and it's like, oh, it all makes sense now.
But it doesn't, because they still assume that it's Cray. They assume that Cray wants to cover it up. And then I just wanted to like go crazy and like flip the TV over, because of course it wasn't Cray. It's not until they finally knock the mask off later that they do finally realize that it wasn't Cray, that it was the crazy professor who's so blinded by revenge that he's willing to go to extreme lengths. And of course, this mirrors Hero, who is so blinded by rage over his dead brother that he's willing to go to extreme lengths.
One thing that I did not see coming was, for a moment, I wanted to give our masked character the benefit of the doubt, and I wanted to think that whether it be Cray or Callahan, I wanted to think that they were reassembling the machine, trying to sort out whatever issue was so then he could recover his daughter. I did not think that he was trying to rebuild take the good part of the portal back to the mainland and use it to destroy Cray's fancy new building and then throw him into it. Like, my first instinct was to say, let's try and sort out whatever the bug was, and maybe once we have that sorted, she'll come flying out the other side like she was supposed to, or I can go back in and get her. But like, no, they go right to revenge plot.
Well, that's what they need to do, because this is a superhero movie, so you need to have your supervillain, and you need to have your supervillain's master plan, and you need to have the thwarting. And they needed to get to the thwarting. You can't like go to just like productive, like everybody helping each other mode. That's not the kind of movie this is.
In the beginning, it's not a superhero movie. When he's in the robotics lab, it's smart people doing cool stuff. So they could all band together and use their smarts to try and save the person. Or, I thought maybe the smart robotics lab kids are going to come together and fix the problem with Callahan's machine that he couldn't figure out himself, because they're all geniuses. And then when working together, they could figure out whatever went wrong and then then rescue his daughter. Like, I thought that they were going to play that angle a little bit. But no, the smart kids... They use their smarts to build superhero costumes, and then they stop being smart kids. They start being superheroes, which kind of annoyed me. Like, I thought they could have just, you know, they could have gone... There's a little bit of real genius in this, where it's the smart kids bandying together. But, like, they didn't really solve the problem with their smarts. They solved it by building some not super awesome superhero costumes out of their science projects and then using that to fight Mr. Callahan.
Well, first of all, Hero, for some reason, is the one who makes all the costumes. So
right, right. He builds it out of their projects because apparently they couldn't figure that out.
Yeah, and he 3D prints them all because he's so smart. I mean, the sheer production capacity of this child who lives above a cafe in San Francisco is kind of strange. Because you'd think if he was actually just able to like fire up a couple things and 3D print out like armor, that or laser weapons, that perhaps other people in this world were also superheroes. Like it wasn't just like a new thing.
But, and this is also the thing where, you know, he's so proficient with all this. So I was like, okay, maybe he's the chosen one and he's going to fix the Stargate and then they're going to be able to rescue the girl. Like, no, he's just going to build, build armor and weapons and then they're going to go fight.
Yeah, well,
which I guess sells better for kids, right, or something, because you can have a Baymax action figure with clip-on armor or something.
Mm-hmm. But the thing that really bugs me about this, though, is also, like you had pointed out, they stopped being smart. And it is very clear they stopped being smart, because they are tripped up by the most basic team movie tropes, cliches, I should really say. That there are in film, where they don't work together, they go in without a plan, and then everything goes bad for them, and then they figure out they gotta work together, and then everything goes great, and then they gotta look at the problem from another angle.
And yeah, you get that weird call out from Hero where he says, "Try it a different way." It's like, thanks, motivational speaker. I guess you're our team leader now.
But literally, that's all he says, and they're all able to just like suddenly perform like, miracle thoughts.
I know exactly what that means. Let's get outside the box, and let's hurry and do it in the next 3 seconds before the microbots kill me.
Oh, God. It really frustrates me, because I've seen them do a better job at telling stories like this in prior Disney feature animation films. Like in Frozen, the twists and turns of the plot are better than they are here. In that, let's just say there might be a character who might actually be a villain that you might have not anticipated. And that in this, it is so obvious watching it be telegraphed the entire time. And it, you know, somebody sacrifices themselves, but in a really interesting way. And then in this, not really an interesting way, not really much of a sacrifice, because it is only a sacrifice insofar as the robot is not able to actually articulate what he has done. He cannot form a direct sentence of, "Hey, I put the memory card here, so you will literally always have me with you." Like,
well, it's partly because he took his memory card out, so he's back to his basic programming, but... Yeah, they had to do that thing where he shows the memories of the dead brother on his little video screen in his chest. That way we actually feel bad when we have to leave him behind. It wouldn't be just enough to have this sort of like tearful, "I can't leave you here" moment, unless that we realized that Baymax was both good and full of memories of the dead brother.
Yeah, but also just the fact that he can't just say, "Hey, I'm going to give you my memory card." Like,
yeah, well, that was... I'm assuming that's because he removed his memory card and he was then back to basic instruction. In the same way that when Bender took out his personality card, all he could say is, "I am Bender, please insert girder."
Mm-hmm. Well, he's still able to carry on a few sentences where he's only able to repeat the fact that "I'll always be with you." And it's like, well, God, just say it, because I knew what it meant.
yeah, I knew that, like, that he was going to take the card. Well, I thought that, at least Hero, being the smart kid again, was going to have the insight to go like, "No, I don't want to leave you," and then get the card himself. But no, he was too overcome with grief, and Baymax had to do the rescuing for him and make sure that the memory card traveled along with him. Like, why did Hero not realize that, like, "Oh, this memory card that we've been playing with on and off for the entire movie, like, I could take that, and then all of this stuff would be there." Like, was he just that overcome with grief?
Well, also, he says, "I'll always be with you," which is the same thing he was saying about his brother's memories. Like, his brother will always be with you. And then we find out that, of course, that's because of the memory card. And it's like, this is obviously a callback to the memory card. You stupid, stupid kid. Like, you're a genius roboticist, and you can't figure out that your robot has said the same thing twice, and it is about a memory card, and obviously he gave you his memory card.
Yeah, and then in another flashback moment, I thought there was another opportunity where they could have used the air in Baymax to deflate. And, you know, since they're in a vacuum, that could have kind of propelled them forward. Like, maybe Hero could have poked a hole and squeezed him real hard, and then they could have fired forward. Maybe that wasn't enough thrust. But, you know, then again, they are in a vacuum, so it would have gotten them there eventually. But who knows? Maybe the portal had closed by then. So they had to use the fist rocket thing. So
yeah, well, fisting. So
no, that is definitely not PG.
I don't care. Any kid? No, there are no kids listening to this. Fortunately, although they're going to miss out on our wicked string cheese spray idea. But the catch it in your mouth. But the whole thing here.
So it's really a great thing for everyone involved that you are not in the advertising business.
No, it's. God, can you imagine the level of inappropriate, terrible things that would be? Anyway, but the
yeah, I can imagine you're doing it right now.
Oh well, yeah, go figure. I'll always be with you, Dan. I'll have a memory card, and it'll just be my terrible ideas, and I'll leave it to you. Whenever you miss me, you could just fire it up, and it'll just spit out some terrible, horrible. Some innuendo product.
You'll always be with us because we're going to sell defocused, preloaded on a memory card where everyone can always have memories of these terrible podcasts to take with them.
Oh, we should sell thumb drives. Everybody needs thumb drives. I don't know. I've been very harsh on this story up until this point. So I want to say a lot of things that I really do like about it because otherwise everyone's going to think I hate everything again. Which is, you know, not the case. Like, I did like this movie, and I laughed, and I enjoyed watching it. I found it very frustrating at these story points, but there are good things in here. Plenty of good things. And it is totally worth everyone's time to see it. I thought that there were some charming aspects to Fred's nerdery and his mansion and the butler. I mean, it's sort of Avengery, but whatever. It was cute. And then the, you know, portrait of Stan Winston, cause you gotta have a Stan Winston cameo in your Marvel movie. And this is literally a Marvel movie, so you have to have him. And you have to make sure you stay to the end of the credits because there's gonna be an end of credits scene. And I did, and I was rewarded because there was Stan Winston, his superhero father, and he makes the underwear joke. But the, That poor old man. But it was interesting in this way. And they had some very cute stuff with Aunt Cass, who was played by Maya Rudolph. She literally goes away for like 45 minutes of this film, where we don't see her hero of Aunt Cass at all. The parts that she's in are a lot of fun. I particularly like her references to spicy foods.
Because you've made that joke before.
Yeah, you know, feeling that later. But the, it was good stuff. And the kid was not cloying. Like, I didn't feel like it was that sort of a thing. Like, he was obviously sophisticated enough in being able to convey all of the sort of like teenagery angst that he needed to convey, and the older brother was able to be older brothery enough in all of the important ways that he needed to be for the film. So this is all decent stuff, and the way he misses him, it all makes sense. And he doesn't feel like putting forth his effort anymore once his brother is gone. Reminiscing about his brother's hat, which was sort of iconic for his brother. In the short time that we met the brother, we saw that sort of is a symbol for him, and he becomes attached to it. So there is a lot here and in the story that is meaningful in an emotional and comedic sense that I think is good. And that, you know, they don't have any pointless love stuff grafted on here. It's not like the Lego movie where all of a sudden, Elizabeth Banks turns into an idiot and can't do anything anymore when she was a super genius at the beginning of the movie.
That just happens because the Oracle made a prediction and that one day she would fall in love and that one would be the special. And I think I'm mixing two things up.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what I mean. At least nobody fell in love because I would have punched something.
all right, you want to just run down the VES awards real quick? So we've got outstanding animation in an animated feature motion picture, which the animation was quite good. Outstanding animated character of Baymax, which I love Baymax. He's my favorite. Outstanding models, City of San Francisco, and outstanding effects simulations, presumably for the microbots, and outstanding created environment into the portal. So I imagine that is the inside the Stargate world where they go to rescue the daughter. Yes. I don't know about you, but like the second I like the first shot of the San Francisco Golden Gate something bridge, as soon as I saw that, I go, huh, that's the Golden Gate Bridge, but Japanified. And I immediately understand that you've made this world. Like, it took me all of one shot to understand that they have created this like sort of combination fake world of San Francisco and Tokyo. I don't know about you, but like, I got that immediately. I'm perplexed by the idea of why they did that, but I immediately understood it the second I saw that.
Yeah, I mean, well, it didn't need to literally be. It's not that it would have been better had it literally been San Francisco. So you might as well just make it whatever anyway.
I didn't really see a reason that they didn't just pick a city. Maybe it was because they could have more fun with the names of the schools or something, but those were all pretty downplayed too. It's just, it's a city like San Francisco that has a bunch of the different types of neighborhoods and areas.
Well, that might make more of a, maybe perhaps it is explained in a better way in the graphic novel, comics this is based off of.
I didn't know this was based on a comic book.
I said Marvel like 10 times, Dan.
They're not allowed to just make stuff up?
No, they're not allowed to make things up. They have to draw them first. Okay. So somebody drew this.
I didn't know that was a rule.
Yes, it's a huge rule. Somebody drew this, and then it had stories, and those stories that they drew, and they did the things, that's what this is based on. So it's not a completely...
I guess that makes sense now, because how many times do we talk about converting existing IP, whether it be a book or a comic book, into a movie, and how they cram 10 pounds of crap in a 2-pound bag, and it ends up coming out super cobbled together and doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. There's definitely... This probably isn't 10 pounds in a 2-pound bag. This is probably like 10 pounds in an 8-pound bag. It's still too much, and there's not enough breathing room for things, but it definitely does feel like this came from somewhere and it's adapted.
Yes, well, it is. But like you're saying with the awards that this was awarded, they are all mostly artistic, visual things. And I can confirm that they all look great to me. Especially the simulated environment of inside of the portal, which is like this swirly cotton candy, oil painting goo stuff, which is just absolutely stunning to look at. Because it's not like it's just like a distorted painting. Like they have volumes that make up the space here, and the debris of the Cray building. Debris is incredibly difficult to do in 3D from scratch because you have to simulate all of the properties of whatever it is you're breaking. Otherwise, it just looks like you just cracked a nothing in half. You know, you got the broken glass pieces, you got shards of broken glass and the way it cracks, and you've got like concrete pieces and, you know, bent beams and stuff like that. Like, when the building is being destroyed, being sucked up into the portal, and then the parts of it floating around afterwards, like all of that stuff is really difficult stuff to do. So it's not trivial in any particular way. When you do this kind of stuff with a model, you kind of get a lot of stuff for free if you build the model out of all of those things. If you just paint balsa wood, then you don't get any of that for free. But, this level of sophistication, is definitely worthy of considerable applause. The microbots, are able to be animated in a very interesting way. And I would be very curious about how they rigged that. Because I would bet they used some sort of a rig to block in basic geometry and animation and then fill it in with instanced geometry later when they went to render it. Because of the way everything moved, it sort of filled out the volume of a shape. I would assume that they were able to lay down shapes, and then cram them full of microbots later, where they're able to programmatically procedurally fill it with the little things. It is all very interesting and cool looking. And the other major thing in this film is they made their own ray tracing renderer for the very first time for this. Previously, Disney Feature Animation had used RenderMan for all of their stuff. And RenderMan is, of course, the renderer made by Pixar. And Pixar uses it for everything. And they also sell a commercial version to everyone. And Disney Feature had been using a commercial version of RenderMan. And while they do share technology back and forth between the two studios, Disney Feature here in Burbank felt they needed to have like full creative control over what they were doing technically with this. They apparently, from what I've heard, they have a little bit of a not invented here syndrome sometimes, where they just sort of make things because they can. And that's not a criticism really, because they can do some really cool stuff as exhibited by this film. And it definitely financially paid off to be worth their investment. I would wager, since the film has, I think, passed 500 million, internationally or something like that right now, this past week. So and they're only going to keep making more money, because it's not going to go into home video release until the 24th or something like that. So this movie prints money. And it is well worth whatever technological investment they wanted to make. And the renderer that they made for this, Hyperion, is a ray tracer, as opposed to RenderMan, which is primarily, a raster renderer, is what it started as. And then it was sort of like had ray tracing stuff glued on the side of it, over the years. And that has become more advanced over time, but it is still at its guts a raster renderer, which cheats a lot of things. And this is all based on being physically accurate, much like the Arnold renderer is, which is used at places like Sony Pictures. And there's a commercial version of Arnold, which is sold to many other places, and they use it in different things, like Gravity used Arnold. And that is all about physically based lighting, and so is Hyperion. They have many similarities from what I was reading in all of the technical stuff they've released about how it works. There's a really good article that Effects Guide put together where they did some analysis between different things. But, you know, I don't know, in terms of performance, like what's better or whatever, who cares? But the...
I'm sure somebody cares, whoever's running those servers.
Well, I know, but I mean in general, like the listeners. No, nobody...
No, they're not listening anymore.
Yeah, no, everybody turned it off at this point. I said rendering engine, and everybody's like, oh, God, pause it. Delete. But the... Unsubscribe. The whole thing here is like with ray tracing stuff, there's all these advantages with like instance geometry where they can reduce memory. So like all the little microbots are instanced, and I'm sure they are able to have like crazy low memory, but have tons of geometry. And especially when it comes to environments like San Francisco, where they need to populate all of the buildings, all of the cars, all of the people. There are several scenes where he's chasing, Hero's chasing Baymax. As Baymax is tracing the route for his little bot compass, and they're going through like, you know, bus terminals and crowded city sidewalks and stuff like that, and there's puddles on the ground. All of this stuff would have been very difficult to do, and not look the same in something like RenderMan, because it just doesn't work the same way. And so that is also another reason why you see so many reflective surfaces in this film, like whenever they have the opportunity to, because it's basically, it's something they can do now. As opposed to, you know, like if you look at Frozen, there's not a lot of really reflective stuff. The Ice Palace is very reflective, but like in general, everything's kind of got like a little bit of a matte finish to it. And that's generally the aesthetic that most of the time you see in an animated film. So to see them put this all together and like make their city and do all this stuff, I think I saw there's a somebody from Disney Feature, Bruce Wright, had tweeted that they used HDR extensively for filling and lighting in these scenes. That doesn't mean they lit everything only with HDR lights, because of course they wouldn't. They didn't actually have a set, but they would use it for like sky domes and stuff, and then that way you can get a gradation of light over a large area. You can get that feeling of the light from the sky, that fills in all the cracks and crevices of things. That kind of stuff. It is really sophisticated and it's very good. And I applaud them very much for what they did. The subsurface looks interesting on the human skin because sometimes that can look like gummy bears. it's all good stuff. I like it.
Yeah, I was going to ask you how a renderer like this stacks up for our main character, Mr. Baymax, who's kind of that soft. He's kind of a matte color, but he's also partially transparent, and we can see through him at times, especially when he like glows and does things like that.
Yeah, well, I don't know specifically how they would have done it in Hyperion, but I'm going to assume that it is set up in a way that is sort of similar to what I'm familiar with, which would be that they have a refraction capability with it, where the light is able to pass through, where basically you use refraction on every surface to determine the Fresnel, which is like the reflection, especially around like you would notice like a Fresnel on like the edges of something like car paint or whatever, like shiny edges. It all has to do with the index of the refraction, like the ability of light to pass through or transmit through something is also linked to the Fresnel, the shininess of the exterior stuff. There's all kinds of scientific papers about how it's linked, and I couldn't tell you because I have an art degree and I don't know shit. But the whole thing basically boils down to they can shoot a ray through Baymax and they can sort of blur it out to sort of have it go in different directions. And then that way it can diffuse over an area through either depth to imply a volume. So like if you have a gummy bear, well, not a gummy bear, it's too small. If you have marble, if you have like a marble statue or something like that, thin edges of the statue will transmit light more readily, but the like thick core part or whatever will appear to be mostly solid. And that has to do with light passing through it. Like as the light goes through, if it's bounced off in different directions as it's passing through, then it doesn't pass all the way through and then you don't get light on the other side. So there's, it gets complicated, but that it's basically sort of the same principle. It's like light goes into Baymax, but it doesn't always go through Baymax. It will get bent and not always fall out the same side of Baymax. it's boring, but it's basically, it produces really neat, very physically accurate results, for what you would expect. And like, you know,
for dummies like me, it's safe to say that Baymax did benefit from their new renderer.
Yes. Well, they could have done it with him specifically, they could have done in RenderMan, like all of the characters they could have done in RenderMan. There is nothing about them that is unique to this. The microbots, I think, would have probably been more difficult because of the way that RenderMan instancing works, but I can't say for certain because they probably wouldn't have traced all of them. They probably would have just done, you know, little specular gags or little reflection map gags. And then faked like maybe some overall reflection occlusion pass or something like that. You don't have to fake any of that stuff if everything's physically accurate like it is here. So it is really good stuff. And I don't want to ramble too much more about it because it's hard to explain. And I'm probably sure I would continue to do as poor of a job as I am doing right now on an audio podcast. But suffice it to say, it is worth the investment that they made. They did a good thing. It looks good. And it's physically accurate. They also used this for their short, which was attached to the film when it was originally shown in theaters, and it was also it's also released with the film on home video, which is called Feast. And that they actually went with a non-photoreal look. And I'd be really curious to find out how much of that they were fighting the physically accurate rendering system that they were using and just doing it with 2D hacks, because let's just say I might have worked on something and maybe it wasn't photorealistic but used a photorealistic render, and maybe that thing required a lot of work in order to massage it to not look like a photorealistic render, in order to art direct, as they would say, so light hits exactly on this edge and, you know, shadow falls exactly here. That stuff is not something you get out of the box when it comes to a physically accurate system. And in fact, the stuff that you get out of that box, requires you to fight the box in order to get the cheated stuff that you need to have. So to see how different that is, and it's from the movie, and know that they use the same systems, is interesting in and of itself. And it'll be very interesting to see where they go from here with what they're doing, but I would assume that they are not going to do much more in the way of cel-shaded stuff, and they certainly probably won't release another feature like that, because that kind of defeats the point of the photorealistic render. I would assume they do stuff that is more like the actual feature film going forwards. In other productions that they release from Disney Feature, it will probably look just as pretty and shiny and glossy and have light transmitting through surfaces. It'll be great stuff.
I did like the look of the little short there, Feast.
Mm-hmm. The little French, so maybe, French bulldog.
Yeah, so maybe whatever tech they built for that too, or whatever they had to do to fight their renderer to make that happen, maybe they can hang on to that look for a little bit.
Yeah, whatever. Give me the pretty shiny voluminous clouds and all that stuff. I thought that was all great.
Yeah, the portal stuff looked really cool. It kind of looked like some of those deep space photos of galaxies and things that just sort of imagined in a large volume that is not just a colorful NASA photo.
Nebulae. Yeah, and like when they're sitting on top of the mysterious turbine things, there's that scene of them up there at like sunset time, and all the clouds are surrounding them. Like that looks actually pretty neat. In terms of like the clouds looking, you know, cloud-like, as opposed to like cards or something floating there.
Yeah, they did some other San Francisco style fog at times too that looks pretty good.
Yeah, I think that they did an amazing job, and they deserve all of the praise that they got for all of the technical aspects of this, and more really. And it honestly, if I had the opportunity to work at Disney, I would jump on it just to play around with this, because it looks like a ton of fun for a lighting compositing nerd like me.
I agree. And on top of that, I gotta say, I loved Baymax. He's a goof of a character played by Scott Adsit, but there are so many great moments for him in this movie. I like that when he runs low on battery, he is drunk and stumbling around. And when he gets holes in him, he inflates and puts tape on it. It's just this giant baby walking around, and he's hilarious.
Well, I really do agree with everything. Like I really do like him quite a bit, but it kind of took me out a little bit that he was acting so drunk. it's a silly criticism because it's funny, but at the same time I was thinking too much about what was happening, and I was like, but he's a robot. Like if he had low power, wouldn't he just not move and not talk? And I don't know.
Well, he's got to have some part analog technology in him, like with the tape player in Apollo 13, when it starts getting super cold and like the tape player is dying, and it starts playing in super slow motion where it sounds like it's dying. So maybe he's got that thing going on.
Hairy baby. No, but
petting the cat.
Yeah, but it doesn't really need to make much sense. But you know, I'm sure some kid in the audience is like, oh, that's just like dad, mom. Then it's just like the parents are so concerned.
Yeah, and we also get the other fun bit that was kind of Matrixy about him, where they download the kung fu onto a new memory card and stick that in there, which was kind of hilarious.
Well, there was one major story point which we did not discuss, and I had a major issue with. And now that we've said so many nice things again, I'm going to go back and saying not nice things. And that is when Hero decides to go homicidal and take out the good medical helpy great chip and then throw that on the ground, and then we get red eyes Baymax gonna destroy kind of stuff. That was very peculiar. Because not just in the scene, the way it unfolds, like he's lashing out in a moment of rage, and then, you know, the friends all realize what's happening and they get beat up, but they put the card back in, and then he calms down. and then they jet off after the professor. But the way that unfolds is so incredibly shocking because it is literally destroy this human being. And then...
Well, let's not forget that the kid is 14 years old and he throws a bit of a temper tantrum because he realizes that his brother died in vain for this guy that they thought was super nice, but actually turns out to be a bad guy. So yeah, he lets his 13, 14-year-old emotions get the best of him and just sets it to Baymax smash.
Yes, except then later on when they have that scene in the when he's fixing the scanner, his super scanner, and he has like the change of heart about things and realizes that it wasn't great. All of the friends show up, and they're like, "Everything's cool. We understand." It's like literally this was a homicidal robot because of this kid, and he unleashed it on another human being, and everyone's just like, "This is okay."
Well, they understand. They were friends with Tadashi. They're sad he's gone, and they understand that this was like the kids. They're both already orphans, and then his brother, who is his like his idol, for at least the end of his life, is killed trying to save this guy, who actually turns out to be super not worth the saving.
Yeah, but then instead of being like we are able to deal with the situation that had happened. It won't repeat itself again because we're not going to go out as a team and do any of these crazy shenanigans because you might lose your cool. They're just like, okay, let's go back to it. And it's like, wait a minute. time out. you guys are all okay working with this homicidal teenager who might at any moment remove a chip and that can send this robot to go off and beat up not only whatever his target is, but you all as well if you interfere with him. Like
he had a lapse in judgment and they found out about Callahan. It's not like he's going to have another instance of finding out about the guy who killed his brother.
No, but what they don't know him really that well at all.
Yeah, but Tadashi was their best friend collectively somehow, or so they say. So they're going to do all that they can to defend him or something. Maybe they're just fascinated by their fun new superhero costumes. Who knows?
Yeah. They're high on the fumes of that 3D printed stuff. But it's just one of those things that I was just like, this is a very severe moment in a Disney film. For children that teaches you that homicide can be forgiven so very easily.
Well, they don't actually kill anyone, and I think the reason that's there is, like I said, because a 14-year-old kid could understand that nuclear reaction to something so dramatic.
Oh, right. Yeah, so it was only attempted homicide. But the...
Yes.
God. Speaking of Law and Order. But it's so strange, and yet they still follow him as he leads them into battle once more. So weird.
Well, assumedly, when they find out about Callahan, they feel a bit betrayed as well at the their former leader, who is now partially responsible for the death of Tadashi.
Assumedly,
yeah.
Okay.
Let's. Yeah, they probably aren't reading into it that much. They're college students. They're not that smart.
No. So I think we talked about all of the things.
Yeah. I do like the Baymax. Most of my laugh out loud moments were just watching Baymax be silly.
Yeah, the non-verbal interactions of Baymax are some of my favorites. Especially
his proportions, the way he walks, the way he pokes his inflatable stomach.
Mm-hmm. When they're breaking into the warehouse, and he can't fit through the window, and then he has to release some air, and then it's just that long squeal of air being released. And then he has to release some more air, and then it just keeps going. And then the tape at the police station.
Yes, I love that.
Like all of those things, they're not acting performances on the part of Scott Adsit, who turns in a great verbal performance. They're all parts that animators contribute to it, and so it is really great to see them do that. And I thought they had a bang up job.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I like Baymax. I want to see more of him.
Well, you might, because they might be teasing another Big Hero 6 movie. I don't know. What do they call it? One Big Hero 7?
Probably, since Stan Lee would be the 7th.
Or will it be a Big Hero 6S? because Stanley starts with an S, and it'll be mid-cycle refresh.
Oh, man.
Will there be a Big Hero C, S6C?
Yeah, Baymax will be in blue and pink and green and yellow.
Yeah. Will it be like a lime green? I'd buy that. Oh, and another thing.
It'll be a little slower, a little more fragile.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, we're all fragile, really, when you get down to it. That's what Baymax understands. Speaking of which, he is a robot that Tadashi was testing in order to ostensibly make a lot more of him in order to help people of the world. Question. From the end scene, it appears that he has been repurposed to solely be part of a superhero team and just have one of him. So that's a little weird, because wouldn't ideally the end result, the ultimate end result, be to see Tadashi's dream fulfilled and to have him fulfill healthcare roles throughout the world?
Well, yeah, but that's probably only because Tadashi didn't have the imagination to consider that Baymax could be a superhero.
Oh, right.
Because really, Baymax is just there to help people, and he's best able to help people by becoming a superhero and learning how to fly, because, you know, learning how to fly increases his ability to help people, or whatever that line was he said. But no, you're totally right. Maybe it's more political. Maybe it's that Tadashi invented him while he was at the college, and additional Baymaxes would be the property of the college, and they can't have this wonderful technology fall into the wrong hands.
Mm-hmm. Because then you'd have...
Although, you know, Callahan probably lost his position at the university, don't you think?
Yeah, but you know, the military could use these, because all you need to do is just tell them to kill something, and then they'll do it when they don't have their healthcare chip.
Well, yeah, once you deactivate their empathy chip.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they don't have the three laws of robotics.
Yeah.
Not like Alan Tudyk's character Sonny in iRobot.
Or perhaps maybe his empathy chip gets overwhelmed by some sort of electrical shock, and then it burns out, and he loses control of his better motor functions, and it just goes on a killing rampage, and just he can't stop himself from harming people.
Yeah, that'll be great.
I mean, but you know, he only has two arms instead of, say, like six. But presumably, if something were to damage his empathy chip, it would be rather difficult for him to not be evil.
I guess. And maybe that'll be the plot of Big Hero 6S. But
Big Hero 6S, mm-hmm. Dr. Octopus Returns.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. And then that one, Kray will actually be the villain. And won't that be a twist? I don't know.
As long as somebody in the movie says that shit, Kray. You want to button this up?
Yeah, Dan, I just have one question for you. Are you satisfied with your care?
Never.
Oh, well, I'm going to deactivate it anyways, because screw you. Hairy baby.